Welcome to Upfront. I'm Chloe Morgan.
And I'm Rachel O'Sullivan.
Well, that was an eventful, underscored, in bold, Conti Cup final, wasn't it? Arsenal have won the first silverware of the season after they beat Chelsea 1-0 in front of a record Conti Cup crowd. But that's only half the story. We're here to recap everything from Freedom Arnhem's terrifying collapse to Emma Hayes' spat with Jonas Eidevall, and where both sides go from here. Plus, we celebrate the game-changing career of England legend, the icon that is Steph Hawson, after she announced her retirement last week. And 40 years on from England reaching the final of the first ever UEFA Women's Euros, we're joined by a legend at the heart of that special team. Right, Rach, obviously before we get stuck into the drama, the trials, the tribulations, what was your moment of the weekend?
Every time you ask me this and every time I'm not prepared.
You're never prepared, are you?
I'm never prepared.
No.
I might give it to Stina Blackstenius for getting the winning goal because, you know, I've been a fan of hers for a while and kind of backing her for a while, and I'm going to give her that because she was so delighted when she scored. And
didn't even just fall over this time.
Well, that was a pretty standard goal, in fact. But I think as well, you know, and I'm one of them, when I saw the team sheet, I was a bit like, oh, interesting, he's gone with Stina. Didn't really work the last time they played Chelsea. What was not the case? So that's mine. What about you?
I'm going to give it to Ella Toon. Obviously, she's had a bit of a sort of, you know, inconsistent season, I think, for Manchester United. But they walked away with the win 4-1 against Everton. Her double on Sunday means the first time that a United woman has reached 50 goals for the club,
which
is such an iconic moment for her. So congratulations, Tune. Right, moving swiftly on to one of the most dramatic of Sundays. I was all prepared, sitting on the sofa. I had a nice IPA in one hand. I had a couple of Easter eggs in the other. I was thinking this is going to be a couple, a few, as many as I could handle in one hand, to be honest. I had a cream egg. I had like a
mini egg.
There was some Smarties in there as
Lint
well.
Bunny.
Yeah, just anything I could cram into my face, to be honest. And obviously, I was expecting a very tasty fixture. Arsenal-Chelsea, the last matchup of these two sides. And what a game it was. I honestly don't even know where to start. There is so many talking points on the agenda.
It was so long.
But should we start with the actual game itself before we get into the very controversial moments that happened? It was so balanced. So the final possession stats at the end were 50-50. It was pretty much foul for foul, corner for corner, like free kicks for free kicks. It was like everything that you wanted. I mean, there was these beautiful memes sort of coming out. First off, I mean, you sent me a couple because I find them absolutely hilarious. I'm sitting in bed scrolling through my phone and Rach sort of pops off with the old TikTok and I was like, I don't even know how to use TikTok, but let me in. And there was this like was it a meme of like Emily Fox opening, like lifting out her pockets at the end of the day? Like there was a picture of a purse, a picture of her keys, and a picture of Lauren James, and I was in bits. I was in absolute bits.
Tell you what, there was a similar picture after Chelsea played Arsenal with Eve Perisset emptying her pockets of the Arsenal players. So yeah, that's a classic meme.
But I think because of that, I mean, like when you look at
when you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Sort of like how, I mean, Chelsea obviously drew the first blood. Mayra Ramirez's disallowed goal.
Which was a lovely goal.
Which was an absolutely beautiful goal. Absolutely ridiculously powerful shot. It was just one of those, and you're thinking automatically, okay, it was quite early doors. Chelsea seemed to be a little bit more on the front foot at this point. But then the goal was disallowed. It went to VAR. VAR being used in the Conti Cup final. And thank God it was, with all the controversy that's happened in sort of recent weeks. But it was disallowed because of an Erin Cuthbert handball. It didn't seem like a really kind of like obvious handball, but it obviously was, and the goal was disallowed, and Arsenal felt like, well, they got another lifeline, didn't they?
Big came back into Arsenal it. Fans, yeah.
But like that, the disallowing of that goal seemed to be the kind of rocket, the kind of kick up the backside that Arsenal needed, because then I felt like the game kind of shifted and they were the ones who ended the first half stronger. I mean, what was your thoughts on the first half?
They came together, didn't they, after that? The Arsenal team came together. Yeah, a little huddle and we're like, lads, get your shit together. I think you're absolutely right in terms of how finely balanced it was. And it's, you know, it's hard to kind of say this is where the battle was won. This is exactly where one team dominated or the other team dominated, because I think actually if either team had won that game, you wouldn't say, oh, they didn't deserve it.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean?
Sure, absolutely.
It was so close. They both had chances. I think Arsenal edged it. I think they edged it in terms of quality chances and shots on target, and maybe, you know, 50-50% possession. But I think Arsenal probably edged extra time. They edged towards the end of the second half as well. Yeah. But again, it just was so close and so finely balanced. And I wonder whether maybe it was that Arsenal were a little bit better at preventing Chelsea from playing their game plan, if you know what I mean. Maybe that's where it was, you know, they were much better at handling Lauren James, I think, this time round. You know, they're putting two players on her a lot of the time, which is probably the only way you can stop someone as good as Lauren James.
Absolutely.
She still broke through a number of times, but I think that was an area they had identified. I thought Victoria Pavlova in midfield was excellent.
Yeah.
She got player of the match at the end. But I think maybe that was where it was, that midfield battle. It was not giving Chelsea any time on the ball, kind of forcing them long a couple of times. But still, you know, Chelsea were getting in, they were getting down the wings, you know, Guro Wrighton came on.
But they weren't the kind of silly mistake. You know, like we were talking before about how is the game going to be won and lost? Yeah. And it was on, okay, are Arsenal going to be making silly mistakes out the back? Are they going to be exposing themselves? And we didn't see that. We saw a more tight-knit defensive unit, which I absolutely loved. Zinsberger, again, I mean, we were talking about some of like LJ's breakthroughs and stuff. There was a really crucial, important save that she made with sort of like, it was like a, like she was like spanning across. It was a 1v1 and it was kind of, if anyone can see this on video.
They can, but I can describe it. She looks like she's just seen a spider. Both arms are up in the air and her left leg is up as in a kind of Disney princess sort of way. And that is Innsbruck.
And that was my style as a keeper, to be fair. I did sort of channel my inner
Spider
sort of
and Disney.
Elsa. Yeah, but I think that was such an important stop. And I've got to also give credit to Hannah Hampton, because she
that
had
Katie
the absolute
save.
Game of her life. Yeah, it was definitely a great keeper fest. But yeah, it was so balanced. I mean, Rachel Brown-Finnis on comms for the day, she was kind of saying, it is a game. This is like when we were getting towards like 85th minute. And so she was like, the game is so finely balanced. It's going to become on moments. It's going to be either mistake
like chess,
or a moment of brilliance.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
And like, you know, Emma said afterwards, she didn't think it was a game of high quality. I don't think either team played their absolute best, but I also think that's because both teams were playing well and preventing the other team from reaching their best. You know what I mean? And so we had this kind of like battle, these chess pieces, you know, moving bits here and there, trying to make an attack without leaving yourself wide open at the back. I think there were the quality in terms of where it lacked quality was those moments of those through balls or those balls over the top or that pass, you know, threading that pass, and they just be off for both teams by a centimetre.
A hairline.
Or they just be offside. Mm-hmm. And it was those little moments that they were almost there for both sides. So it was, that's where it felt like it was millimetres. It was one in those kind of really, really small moments. And I just think Arsenal, as I said, edged it in extra time, which is probably what gave them the confidence to go and get that goal, because they'd gotten in a couple of times. Caitlin Ford came on, stretched the play.
Yeah.
You know, Chelsea were tired, understandably, are playing games every three bloody days. And I think that was probably something that Arsenal recognised. The longer the game went on, we need to tire them out and get some fresh legs on and
fatigue.
Stretch the play. So I think that helped as well. But overall, it was such a finely, finely balanced game.
Wasn't it? I mean, there was no surprise when it kind of went into extra time. And then we were thinking, okay, well, like, this is one of those games that could easily go to penalties. And to be honest, penalties kind of felt like the safest way to kind of, like...
Yeah, but also, like, such a shit way to end a game, isn't
it? I think,
like,
for the 21,000 fans that came to the Molyneux Stadium, I was thinking, that is exactly what you want.
I hate when games
that
go on penalties.
That is bang for your buck, that is.
Imagine playing that long and then going, oh, it's just come down to penalties.
Yeah, but I think that's the only way. In a game like that where it's so finely balanced, you think, actually, it is just luck that's going to win it.
And they must have been knackered as well, because the amount of injury time, we had 4 minutes in the first half, we had 7 minutes in the second half. Of course, we had that really terrifying moment of Frida Monham's medical emergency, which added another, I think, 7 minutes onto the game. Then we had kind of 2 or 3 minutes in each extra time half. So it was a really, really long game, which is not what Chelsea would have needed. And I think as well, like the difficulty for Chelsea was, and for Emma was, where do you make those sacrifices, right? Because they'd played Ajax midweek. They'd made changes midweek. They were pretty comfortable in that tie. They were 3-0 up. They probably knew they could sacrifice there in order to be able to put out a team, a more rested team potentially in that cup final. And I think you then have to balance, do you go with that resting and hopefully having fresher legs, or do you go with momentum where you've just beaten Ajax 3-0? Do you want to carry on that momentum, get the same players out, get them, you know, they're motoring, they're scoring, they're confident. Do you maintain that or do you make that sacrifice? And that's a difficult kind of decision, I guess, for a manager when you're managing this many games. And maybe that was the area where it didn't really work for Chelsea. Like it was Nuskin and Ramirez working together, which was, I'm not sure it worked as well as we might have thought it would. It was an interesting duo up there. So yeah, it's all those little small details and those little moments and those little tactics. And I think that's what you want from a final, is you hope the best two teams are going to get there and really challenge each other.
Absolutely. I think you've almost got to applaud sort of the creativity and some of the matchups and the partnerships that Emma Hayes were kind of playing with. I mean, in context, I mean, they played 8 games in March. They've got the international break now, and then they've got 3 games in 6 days coming up. So they've got Man United away in the FA Cup semi-final on the 14th of April, Aston Villa at home in the WSL on the 17th of April, and then Barcelona away in the Champions League semi-final on the 20th of April. And you think, okay, well, actually, in terms of, you know, obviously everyone's saying, okay, look, Emma Hayes is going to go for the quadruple. That'd be such a fantastic way to end her career with Chelsea. But actually, out of the 4 different competitions that Emma Hayes sort of wants to end successfully on, I do think the Conti Cup is probably the least... I'm not saying it's not important, but I'm saying if you had to rank the most important competitions for Emma Hayes this year, I think the Conti Cup is something that she can forego. And I think the quadruple is something that happens once in a lifetime for managers' careers. And Emma Hayes is so used to not only winning fantastically, but also, well, we'll get on to how she lost in this particular game and her sort of reaction to what had happened. But she is an experienced loser. There are some competitions where actually you've just got to take into the fact that your team were a little bit tired. And on the day, Arsenal were better. Like, it's one of those. But
yeah, she'll still be raging. She'll still be absolutely raging to lose a cup final. You know, there had been talk of the quadruple beforehand. To lose to Arsenal, to lose to Arsenal, though, like at least last year, 3-1, you can just kind of hold your hands up and say, and she did, the other team were better. But to lose on that fine margin would be so annoying, because you're like, oh, almost. We're so almost. And that would have been, you know, the first trophy of 4. So I agree in terms of ranking of the trophies. Conti Cup isn't going to be up there. But you still want that bloody silverware. Absolutely. Particularly taking on Arsenal.
All day. And we will go on to talk in a little moment just about sort of Hayes' reaction to everything that happened post-game. But if we just take it back, and I think you've got to give credit to both teams for how they finished off the extra time. I think given the sort of events around Freedom Ornum, obviously sort of, it didn't really pan to it. I was watching the game from home. Rach, you were obviously there. Can you kind of talk us through like what sort of happened and the kind of atmosphere around, because it went deathly silent on the screen and we didn't know what was happening for quite a few moments.
Yeah, so I was down the other end of the pitch, but I was the same side as where the kind of she fell. And I think you knew immediately that it was something serious, because the play was kind of the other side of the pitch higher up, and you could see Katie McCabe and Jonas Eideveld flagging at the officials, and Black Stenius was the first one over there and could see something was seriously wrong. And I think we kind of knew it was off the ball, but when something like that happens, you're like, was that off the ball? Was there a collision? But there was no one around her. And, you know, through conversations with others that were there, we were like, okay, actually, yeah, this is off the ball, which is always terrifying when you see that many medical staff flood the pitch with stretchers and those big, scary looking medical bags. You know, something is seriously wrong. And we've seen these incidents in the past relatively recently. And I think that's what puts the fear in you. You just hope it's nothing as serious as what we've seen in the past. But when it's something off the ball, that is always scary. It seemed pretty clear that she wasn't conscious as well, which again adds to the fear. And yeah, I think that it's not a pleasant thing to experience. And for everybody in that stadium, we'll probably say the same. There was that kind of deathly silence, as you say, and it took a while, and a very difficult thing for both teams to manage, particularly obviously Arsenal with it being a teammate. But Chelsea as well, to see someone go down like that, it kind of brings everything into a really sharp perspective, doesn't
it? For sure. I think, yeah, I mean, obviously the players were kind of brought over to the side and all we could kind of see was sort of the medical stretcher being brought on. And you think, you know, Frieda Morning, like, she's got a bit about her. She's a very, like, you know, spicy player. Like, she's so physical in the game and, like, but only at 24 years old. And you kind of see the oxygen being administered and you're like, oh my God, like, I was just, you were at the edge of your seat, like, sitting watching it at home. I was like, oh, my,
And when you see the opposite team medical staff go on, yeah, that's when you know it's a serious injury. And for obviously sure. You had the paramedics come on, you know, and just as it went on, like, there were other bags being brought on, and that's when you start to worry. But luckily, I suppose, it wasn't as serious as maybe people initially thought. And we were all kind of, I think when you see the players going back on the pitch and getting ready to play again, that probably
fills you with a bit more hope.
Yeah, because obviously the if it was a very, very serious situation, that probably wouldn't have happened. Either the game would be paused or abandoned or whatever it might be. And I think the fact that they went out to carry on playing, and then, of course, really quickly as well, we got that news through that she was awake and conscious, thank God.
Talking in yeah. a stable condition.
Yeah, so that was kind of big weight off when you heard that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, she was on the pitch for 7 minutes. Obviously, like, she was taken down the tunnel. It was a really lovely moment from the crowd. Everyone gave her a massive round of applause, players, staff, and obviously the 21,000 people present. But yeah, wishing her all the absolute very best. Obviously, I think Arsenal will probably provide more updates. But yeah, Frieda, man, we are thinking of you. Credit to the players as well for carrying on with that. And obviously, you know, her best mate getting the goal, as Russo said at the
that
end.
That was sweet, yeah.
Was very cute, a very apt way. Can you imagine sort of coming out of, you know, having your teammates come into the dressing room and, yeah, being able to tell them that you brought home the first silverware for Arsenal. Probably the only silverware for Arsenal. But yeah, let's get stuck in then to another kind of juicy post-match moment. Just to set the scene, just to set the lovely context, as the game started, you saw this really lovely moment between Emma Hayes and Jonas Eidevall. They're walking down the tunnel, kind of exchanging a few words. It's the last time.
Emma pats him on the back.
They pat each other on the back. It's a really cute moment that's sort of been captured. And it's the last time that these two managers are going to be meeting each other, obviously with Emma Hayes departing at the end of the season. Cut to, 125 minutes later, and all of a sudden, the camera pans to the kind of like the manager handshake. You can understand that Emma Hayes is not happy with the result. She is very competitive. The game has not gone her way. In the final few minutes, she probably thinks it's going to penalties, in which case Hannah Hampton's had an absolute worldie. Zinsberger has as well.
There was rumours that they were readying Ann-Kathrine Berger. We'll never know that.
Really?
Yeah. I had people up in the press box telling me that. I don't know how much, you know, whether that would have happened.
That's very juicy. Okay. Well, very interesting. Chelsea men did that a couple of years back and it absolutely backfired. I think they put, like, is it Kepa in goal? And it went absolutely sideways. So, and I think I would have been a bit fuming if I was Hannah Hampton, because I think you're so full of confidence because you've just made these worldly saves during the game. You're already kind of like in the moment. That to me wouldn't have made sense.
So we don't know if it would have, but
yeah, we're hypothesizing and we're getting away from the actual drama. Yeah, we're getting away from the fake news into the actual drama.
Oh my God, absolutely fake news.
But yeah, and then cut to, the camera pans to the manager handshake. Jonas Eidevall sticks his hand out. Emma seems to stick her hand out as well. And then they kind of like bring each other's body in. And then Emma pushes Eidevall.
That's a great way of just shortening his name, isn't it?
I mean, no one's really come back and said anything about hashtag Sazzy Weeks at the moment. So, yeah, we'll move swiftly on from me trying to, you know, create these ridiculous names for managers. But, I mean, Rach, what was your thought when you saw this? Because I was like...
Well, I don't think she was going in for the hug. She was pointing at him, giving him an angry kind of finger wave. But they did both come together and Emma pushed him. It didn't really kind of unfold until post-match, until we could kind of figure out what had happened. I saw the whole throw-in issue and... basically what happened was which I didn't know was a thing, whether it was a single ball or multi-ball system.
I didn't know you could vote on that.
Me neither. No. And it was a single ball system, which is what Chelsea wanted. Arsenal had wanted a multi-ball system. I'm guessing one kind of maybe slows the play down a little bit, one speeds the play up, obviously. And if both managers can't agree, they go with a single ball system, which was what Chelsea wanted. And then in that situation, Aaron Cuthbert was given a second ball really quickly, wanted to take the throw in really quickly, understandable. Also taking the throw in from about 10, 15 yards higher up the pitch than should have been. Jonas Eidevall and his assistant were... And like, if you watch it, and this is the thing that annoys me about these situations, is you can't just watch a clip and see the black and white thing that's happening. There's like you know,
this could have been happening.
Or yeah, everyone reads this into this, and like then you've got one side saying this and one side interpreting in a different way. And like you can see that Idaval and the assistant are like shouting at whoever threw Aaron the ball, shouting at the fourth official. As we talked about, a match of very fine margins. Mm-hmm. You're gonna take any kind of opportunity you can, if it means gaining a few yards or getting a quick ball.
The extra 1%.
Yeah, and I can understand why Arsenal bench be flipping raging about that, mm-hmm. right? And that's where that kind of was the flashpoint, if you like. And then Aaron turned and kind of went towards Idaval because obviously he annoyed her. So he said something he shouldn't have said or whatever it was. And that was, I saw that kind of happen, but then nothing afterwards. The game just kind of carried on. And, you know, just to clarify, he wasn't booked there. That's not what he was booked for.
No.
He was booked for post-goal celebration.
Yep.
Because the team encroached on
also,
the pitch.
Emma Hayes didn't seem to take too much of an issue with that. Because she was looking straight onto the pitch, like, just seeing where the throw-in was being
taken. She looked over at one point towards the end, but that's actually not where Idaval was booked. He was booked because they all kind of ran onto the pitch when they scored.
And you can't blame him.
Which you're not allowed to do. So he got booked for that. And that was kind of the flashpoint, if you like, which in-game just didn't kind of seem that big a deal. It was kind of afterwards where you saw clips and zooming in bits and slow down bits and you know frames and all that stuff. And I guess when Emma said that he'd kind of confronted one of her players, which actually, when you look at the clip, isn't really what happened.
Didn't look like the reality. Yeah.
No, so it was all just a bit of a storm in a teacup.
But I love it though because people go Poirot on it, like Miss Marple on it. Like, okay, let's take it back a frame. Let's take it back a frame. You can kind of see him mouthing this. It might be this, but it could also be this.
He maybe said that,
but
and she maybe did that, and
but then,
basically storm in a teacup, and then
it
Emma
wasn't a teacup. It escalated from a teacup to a large Pyrex jug.
Yeah, because then afterwards, you know, I think had Emma not pushed him, there's nothing would have happened. No one would have really talked about it. It wouldn't have been a thing. But like the last Conti Cup final, we're now talking about that and not talking about the loss.
Yes. But then off the back of that, obviously, because obviously you know, both managers are going to be asked about that. The big talking point is obviously, you know, one of them is going to be, how is Frieda doing? The other one is going to be, you know, Emma, how are you feeling about, you know, having lost one of your sort of quadruple arms? And the and then Emma's kind of response to what happened, sort of bringing up this phrase, which everyone has, you know, taken there's a lot of attention around, is male aggression. She felt there was been male aggression from Idaval, which is obviously going to provoke some kind of reaction and response. And Idaval wasn't happy about it. He was sort of saying that was a very irresponsible use of the word. And I do have to agree. I don't think there was anything, unless something more comes out and he said something really provocative to Aaron Cuthbert that we don't know about. It kind of just felt like it was one of those moments where Idaval was a little bit upset because, you know, Emma Hayes has already kind of laid her bed. You want the one ball system, and now all of a sudden, when it fits your strategy, all of a sudden you want this kind of fresh ball, this secondary ball.
Also, this doesn't make us Arsenal fans. We're just discussing what happened. FYI.
Because for sure,
this is what happens. We'll get accused of being Arsenal fans this week as opposed to whatever we got accused of last week. We're just discussing the situation as it happened and from the video footage.
Yeah, for sure. And it's the kind of, it's the language used, because that's obviously quite strong terminology to say. And it kind of paints a picture of Idaval as sort of being this male aggressor in a way. And I think that's quite, it can be quite inflammatory, I think.
Yeah, and I think if you're going to talk about being role models and how you conduct yourself pitch side, don't push another manager. It's just not like, ugh, it just doesn't back up your point then, does it? And it just kind of takes away from what you said. And that's what's made this whole kind of...
It's sportsmanship. I think if there had been that kind of level of beef, I think the probably the most appropriate thing would have been done to do is probably to not have shaken his hand and then or have taken some time after that game to reflect and then go back and have that conversation at some point.
Because all of her assistants and stuff shook his hand.
Yeah, it didn't seem to be that much of
And you know what? I think we can forgive managers for heat of the moment stuff.
For
like,
sure.
We see it from all managers. And if it was a heat of the moment thing for Emma Hayes, fine. But I think you can't scrutinise one and not the other. I think both of them would... Do you know what? This is the other thing I'll say. And I saw someone say this on Twitter. Both can be true. Mm-hmm. Idaval could have gone over the top with whatever he said. We don't know what he said. Could have been over the top. Emma Hayes shouldn't have pushed him. Shouldn't have used the word male aggression. Both of them probably look back at it and say, could have conducted myself better. Job done.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, for me, it's a distraction technique.
Yes. But all day, I think congratulations to Arsenal. Emma Hayes did say that at the very end of the press conference. I think it was somewhere sort of, you know, and well done to Arsenal. That was about it.
The face you're making. Again, no, it's so good for a podcast. No one can see the faces. But
it was a brilliant day. Yeah, Nikki Doucette hands out the medals. Obviously, Arsenal, we had Katie McCabe drinking from the trophy again, like pouring her champagne into the trophy, drinking it straight from the Conti Cup, which was amazing.
Do you know
what
was really
cool?
People
spent hours polishing that.
And maybe this should have been the moment of the weekend for me, but it was actually the post-match where all the Arsenal team lined up in front of the Arsenal fans and they sang North London Forever. And
yes,
just like... It's like when you're at any stadium and you hear them all singing. It's like this happens at Liverpool when they sing You'll Never Walk Alone. And they've got players in front and fans singing to them. I saw it. They did it at Bran. They did it in Hacken. Just gives you shivers. Like,
were there more Arsenal fans there than Blues fans?
I didn't count, Chloe, but I think there might have been. But yeah, it was just a really cool moment to see. And I don't want to be all wanky about it in women's football. But, you know, when you've been in the game for so long and you've been at games where there's a couple of hundred people, to see those kind of moments happen in the game are always really special, always gives me goosebumps.
Well, it was a record crowd for a Conti Cup final. So the exact figure was 21,462 fans at the Wolves Molyneux Stadium. It's quite nice, I think, to see a sort of a northern stadium being used. I mean, we've kind of, I feel like there is a bit of a shift to where
a conscious
Birmingham shift.
North? Is this just your London head saying?
Well, it's north of the M25, isn't it? So yes, it's north for me. And I think it is quite nice because I think we do have this kind of maybe London-centric kind of view of women's football. I think where you do have like, sort of, obviously you've got two of the big top four clubs down here, but you've also got two of the big top four clubs up in Manchester. And, you know, Wembley has been used quite a lot on these kind of big, big occasions. But, you know, we are seeing with the Euro qualifier games, we've got England-Sweden, yes, at Wembley. But then we've also got England-France at St James's Park, England versus Ireland at Carrow Road in Norfolk. So yeah, it was quite nice, I think, to kind of, you know, expand the reach of women's football, maybe get a different crowd, different fan base, people who wouldn't have been able to access it if it had been at Wembley.
Sure. I mean, Conti Cup wouldn't be at Wembley, but like part of me wonders if it's something that
could do.
Should it be decided after the teams are chosen? Or like the final, and maybe it's too late to pick a stadium after the finalists have been decided, but part of me wonders, had an Arsenal-Chelsea final being played in London, would we have gotten more people there? Because the Conti Cup, it has been quite London-centric in the last few years, which I don't really understand, because previously you've had it in Nottingham, Sheffield, Manchester, Rotherham, Burton-on-Trent. So like it has moved around. I don't know why the last few years have been in London. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's good to see it move around a bit more and to still get over 20,000 in the middle of, because as always, I'm pretty sure there were train issues. Aren't there always train issues when...
I assume that's the case now.
I assume
for every weekend.
I'm guessing yeah. That's how they plan it. They look at the calendar and when is it going to be super annoying to get some transport? We'll put it there. But I think, you know, so hats off to the fans who travelled and made it. The atmosphere was brilliant. I had the Chelsea fans behind me. They were great. They were chanting. Arsenal fans were chanting. Arsenal would start one chant. Chelsea would pick it up and sing it about Chelsea. And it was cool. It was really cool.
It looks beautiful to watch. It was very beautiful to watch.
And the flags, the blue flags, like it's so such a great contrast of a red wall one end and then these, they all had these blue flags flying. I think it was when they were, I think they were probably playing one of the Chelsea songs before the game kicked off and they all had these blue flags flying. It just looked so cool. It looks amazing when they have that.
Right, let's focus our attentions in the Manchester area. A lot of drama coming out of Man City. But before we get stuck into the kind of big news around legend and icon Steph Horton, just a moment to reflect on Ellie Roebuck's recent news. A City keeper announced on socials that she suffered a left occipital, I hope I've pronounce that right, infarct. She said in a statement that she's not sustained lasting damage to her brain function or vision, but that she is ready to give it all and get back to the thing that she loves most. Just a little bit of medical terminology. I had to look at this because infarct isn't obviously something that sort of crops up in the dictionary that often. It's an area of necrosis in a tissue or organ resulting from obstruction of the local circulation.
It's effectively like a stroke.
Yes, but thankfully it's not as serious as obviously some strokes can be. And it looks like Roebuck will be making a return to football in a sort of more active way. Obviously, at the start of the season, there was a lot of controversy. I was definitely sort of really upset for Roebuck because you sort of come off the back of the last season. Had played pretty much, I think it was about 17, I think, WSL games for Man City the season previously. And then kind of came into the start of September, expecting her to be there and Kiara Keaton to sort of be, you know, filling that kind of youngster, you know, nipping on her heels type role. But then she's been absent for the last 11 City match day squads, sometimes making it onto the bench, sometimes being in the stands. And I think understandably, there was a lot of confusion as to why that sudden shift had happened. She's just come back from the World Cup, obviously had a great season with City. And I think, obviously, for us, you know, journalists, we were trying to find out our best. We were trying to get loads of information on it. We were trying to speak to sources. We were trying to sort of, you know, suss out what was really going on, because even me personally on a goalkeeper level, I was really upset for her. I didn't think there was a justifiable, understandable reason why that had happened. And a lot of people were pointing to the fact that she got a red card, I think, in the last game of the season with City last year. And I was thinking, okay, well, maybe there is, you know, some kind of rift that's happened over that. Or, you know, there was a lot of speculation over to whether, you know, she'd had some disagreements with Gareth Taylor. And whilst those could still be true, but yeah, what were your thoughts sort of seeing the news break last week?
Well, I'm really glad that they were able to figure out what was wrong.
Yeah, for sure.
She was saying how, I think it was January that she was diagnosed or was able to find out what was going on. So I'm really glad they were able to figure out what was going on. It sounds like maybe a difficult thing, obviously, to deal with or diagnose, whatever that might be. So first and foremost, knowing she knows what it is, and she can treat it, and she can hopefully, as she said, get back to doing what she loves best. I think what probably made it difficult for people was that September to January, you were seeing her on the bench. Like, she made the bench 5 times and then she'd just be out of the match day squad. And I think that's where people were like, what is going on? And I think as journalists, you have to ask the question of, your starting keeper now isn't making the bench, what's going on?
And like you said, you wouldn't assume it was a health issue or a sort of physical niggle if you were still, you know, being on the bench, because at some point you could be called on to actually play in the game.
Yeah, so that's it. Like, the being on the bench thing is I think what maybe raised the questions of, if she's making the bench but now she's not making the bench, like, what's going on there? So I'm really glad that they've figured out what it is. I think that kind of September to January period, not knowing what was going on, led to, you know, questions, speculation, kind of a void of information, meaning people were querying, was it, you know, a rift? Is she going to Barcelona? Mm-hmm. All that kind of stuff. Obviously, because you want what's best for the player. You want to see them playing. You know, you want them to be on the pitch doing what they love. So I'm very pleased that they've been able to figure out what's going on and be on the road to recovery.
Yeah, well, she said, it's been a really tough time, but with the support of my family, I'm now in a really positive space and excited for my return to the pitch. Life can throw unexpected challenges at you, and if this year has taught me anything, is that I'm strong, will give it my all, and I'll go for the thing I love most. Very grateful for the well wishes and concerns, and her family would appreciate the privacy while she concentrates on completing her recovery. So from all of us here at Upfront, wishing you the absolute best of luck in your recovery. Moving on then to another very dramatic bit of news for City. Steph Horton announced that she will retire at the end of the season. So just to put into context just how much of a legend this woman is, she won 3 WSL titles and 12 cup trophies across 420 appearances for Man City, Arsenal and Leeds. She also has, I mean, this is such a long list. I mean, her CV is just ridiculous. 121 England caps and has captained the Lionesses at 3 major tournaments. Izzy Christiansen, who also retired last year, wasn't it? And now does a lot of punditry for the BBC, said that England wouldn't have won the Euro 2022 without Horton's work over her career, but she's never made an appearance under Wiegmann. Rach, when you heard the news, what were your thoughts? Because to me, it's always sad to see news like that because of her history, her legacy, what she's done for the game. But it didn't feel unexpected, I don't think.
No, but it did feel a bit end of an era-y.
For sure.
She's one of those trailblazers where, you know, we often talk about trailblazers who came before us. She's one of the trailblazers that was there since I've been working in the game. Mm-hmm.
She's a trailblazer of our generation.
Yeah,
the one.
Which is really cool to have kind of witnessed. And looking back at, you know, how we started Girls on the Ball, I think back to the London 2012 Olympics, that was the spark for us. It was the Team GB versus Brazil game that lit the fire. And that was Steph Horton all over. She was the one who got the goal against Brazil. She'd had this unbelievable breakout tournament, basically scoring in every game. I think she was Team GB's top scorer. And one of my biggest memories and most special memories in football is that roar at Wembley when Steph Horton rounded the player and put it in the bottom of the net and kind of ran to the side of the pitch, laying on her back with all of her teammates sliding in on top of her. And that, you know, I kind of associate Steph Horton with that spark of what started Girls on the Ball and our real passion for women's football. So to then see her retiring now, kind of, it feels a bit like a full circle moment. You're like, oh my God, football without Steph Horton. And I think she was the one who kind of stepped across that, you know, non-professional to professional. She was one of the first to have a central contract. She was the captain that kind of brought the Lionesses into this new generation, I guess, of fans and supporters, and led them to, you know, semi-finals, you know, and getting to that kind of thing. And you kind of associate her with all of those kind of memories that I have watching the Lionesses. So to see her bow out, she's had a brilliant career. Maybe not a huge surprise that she is retiring, but she has had to deal with a lot, but she's also massively impacted the game. And I hope she knows the kind of immeasurable impact she's had on women's football.
She laid the most solid of foundations for the Lionesses. I mean, she led Team GB at the Tokyo Olympics in 2020, and that was the last time that she would captain the kind of nation. I appreciate that goes across, you know, a couple of nations there. But it did seem that there was a big transition, wasn't there, when the arrival of Serena Wiegmann as the England manager in 2021, that sort of sparked this kind of change in direction, this bringing in of a new Lionesses era. Obviously, Leah Williamson then picking up the captaincy in 2022. And then Horton's kind of gone through quite a difficult time since then. There was a kind of, she was quite vocal, I think, about her disappointment at being dropped in the England squad. She kind of had a few injuries, sort of struggling to get fit and make the squad for Euro 2022, which was really painful to watch because you kind of saw someone else in her generation, her era, Jill Scott, kind of go to the Euro 2020s, and kind of, even though Jill Scott didn't get loads and loads of minutes, she still became one of the big icons of the Euro 20s, because that was the kind of pinnacle, wasn't it, I think, for the Lionesses. That was the kind of mainstream incredible moment for the Lionesses that kind of got them into this, you know, space of just, I don't know, even celebrity, I suppose. But then I suppose off the back of that, then you see Jill Scott. She obviously announces her retirement. She's, you know, seen on stage, like, you know, doing this ridiculous interview with the Euro 2022 trophy. She goes into the jungle. But we were just kind of saying before, like, the podcast even started, like, you know, if you'd have only just started listening to Upfront or sort of getting involved in women's football as of like last year in September, you might not even know who Horton is, because she's barely on the kind of team sheets, barely gets any minutes. And you kind of think, well, like, you'd be forgiven for not knowing the kind of impact that she has made over the decades that she's been sort of in and around women's football. But for me, like, she's like one of the first people that I saw in sort of magazines, in papers. Like, she's like the person that I associate with women's football for the past decade. And I just, I'm just wishing her the absolute best in her retirement. But you can kind of see, obviously, like, she's been celebrated for raising quite a bit of money. Her partner was diagnosed with motor neurone disease in 2018, and she's been a massive advocate of the Derby Rimmer MND Foundation, which is set up by her husband, and she's raised so much money for them. You see her doing so much charity work. So I feel off the pitch that, like, she's still going to be just as iconic. It'll be really interesting to see what she gets into. But yeah, it's been quite the career for her.
She did say, as part of her statement, that she hopes that she leaves the game in a better place than when she started. And, like, I can absolutely confirm that you've done that, Steph. I think she can be very proud of her impact on the game, and one really good example of the leadership that she showed. The BBC pulled it out as a moment as well, was in 2019, getting knocked out by the USA in the semi-finals of a World Cup, and she'd had her penalty saved, and she picked herself up and went and spoke to the media afterwards. And she would be forgiven for asking someone else to step in that moment for her, that really difficult moment for her. But no, she had the kind of professionalism and strength to be able to go up and front the media after a really, really disappointing loss in a really, really tight game. And I think that kind of exemplifies her as the leader that she was in that team. And the same for Manchester City. I think even if you don't see her on the pitch, she is hugely important behind the scenes to that team as a leader. So she's absolutely left the game in a better place.
She's almost been like the queen. Do you know, seen through so many periods of transitions, seen through so many kind of like England managers, like prime ministers almost. Like, she's kind of like been that stability, that kind of like rock, that foundation of the Lionesses. So I think, absolutely massive appreciation, massive gratitude for what you've done for the women's game. It will be super sad to have, you know, someone of that, the kind of last of the Lionesses, I suppose, in a way. Still got kind of Millie Bright, still with Demi Stokes. I feel like Steph Horton was, she was absolutely key to that. And I wish her the absolute best in her well-deserved, very well-deserved retirement. On the subject of the Lionesses, in part three, we're going to be joined by an absolute England legend. Pat Chapman starred in the first ever Women's Euros final in May 1984. England lost to Sweden on penalties that day. So 40 years on and a few days before England faced Sweden in a very different set of circumstances at Wembley, we're looking back at that day and Pat's inspiring career. All right, Pat, thank you so much for joining us. So it's almost 40 years since you represented England in the final of the Euros against Sweden, the first ever UEFA Women's Euros, in fact. And it was played over two legs, first in Sweden and then at Kenilworth Road in Luton. You recently returned to Kenilworth Road for the Women's National League final, where Hashtag United beat Newcastle United 2-1 to lift the trophy. What were your thoughts on the game?
I enjoyed the game. I do have to say Luton Town were absolutely fantastic. They treated us so well. We had a wonderful day. It was nice to be back. The pitch was better than it was the first time we were there. But I enjoyed the game. Again, the Newcastle supporters were absolutely amazing. Well, both sets of supporters. They supported their teams, they sung their hearts out, and it was lovely to be back. But Luton were amazing, I have to say.
That's brilliant to hear. And you touched on the pitch there and how nice it was. The pictures of the second leg back in 1984 at Kenilworth Road look so incredibly muddy. Tell us about that.
Well, we played over at the Alevi Stadium. And as like I said before, that then was their national ground. So they were playing on a Saturday afternoon live on TV. Their equivalent of Wembley. Now, no disrespect to Luton, we were at Luton with 2,000 people because there was hardly anything promoting it. It rained incessantly all the time we were there. It just never stopped. And I think that in this day and age, the game would have been off. Well, it would have been a better pitch, but the pitch was just unplayable, really. But because it was what it was, we played, but we were told to keep the ball wide because that was the only place where there was any grass. And that was the only place where it was half decent to play football.
Wow.
But it was good to be back. It was good.
There's almost quite a nice kind of, when you look back at you playing Sweden at Kenilworth Road, you're saying you had played the first leg in their equivalent of Wembley. And now on Friday, we're going to see England take on Sweden at Wembley.
Yes.
Can you believe, like, you look back to when you played them there and now it's being played at Wembley and how far that journey is has come?
Well, it's amazing, isn't it? It is absolutely amazing. And I think the girls deserve what they've got. I think they are a fantastic role model for the youngsters. I would love to have played at Wembley, of course. But, you know, I mean, I just think that we're in such a good place at the moment with women's football. And I'm just very proud that I played a small part. So, yeah, I would like to have played at Wembley. But, you know, that's just that. You know, we didn't and, you know, whatever.
Definitely played a part.
100%. Yes. The foundations of where we are now. And sort of touching on a little bit, I suppose, of the history of the women's game. Of course, the ban on women's football in England was maintained by the FA until 1970. So how did you first start playing at all? How do we get to the situation where you're, you know, playing that game at Kenilworth Road? Can you tell us a bit about your journey?
Yeah. So I had two brothers, and my dad was a sports fanatic. We used to play football. I played most sports, but which I think you'll find a lot of the maybe older people did. I played lots of sports. I played five-a-side football for a youth team. And at the time, the main teams were in Southampton. But I didn't know that. They had a league in Southampton, which I didn't know. But then a friend of mine said she was going up for some trials at Southampton. I went. And that was it, really. I had a knock on the door to say, would I like to play for Southampton? And away we went. But there was nothing in Portsmouth where I lived, but Southampton obviously was the team. But it was five-a-side football, youth club football. That's how I started.
And fast forward to getting that called up for England. Can you remember when that happened, when you got called
Absolutely.
Up to the national team?
Absolutely. You might remember a lady called Sylvie Gore. So Sylvie Gore, unfortunately, isn't with us anymore, but she was a driving force, along with Sue Lopez, with women's football at that time. I was at work, and I'd been for trials, and I was at work. I got a phone call from Sylvie Gore, and I thought, why are you ringing me? I'm not quite sure why you're ringing me. Anyway, she rang me up, said, I've got some news for you. She said, you've been called up into the England squad. And I remember going home and telling my dad, because obviously my mum and dad were fantastic, but my dad, I just looked at my dad, I said, Dad, I said, I've been called up into the England squad. I'm sure he cried. So, yeah, that was how I remember it. And, as I say, the rest is history, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And did you tell anyone at work at all? What were you working at the time?
Well, see, I've, funnily enough, look, I'm going to show you this because I'm actually sitting here writing my resignation.
Because Breaking I've news, worked... yeah.
Well, no, not really, because I've worked for Boots for 52 years.
Wow.
Since I was 16. And I've worked all over the place doing lots of different things. And I retired 5 years ago, but I went back and did a few hours. But now I've enough's enough. I want to travel a bit more. They were fantastic. I told the girls at work because they knew I'd been. They were absolutely thrilled for me. My sisters and brothers and, all the people I knew in Portsmouth. But my company have been absolutely fantastic all these years.
Wow. Love that. I'm a Boots fan. It's where I shop to get all my toiletries in bits and pieces. So
well done, you.
Love that.
Yeah.
So you mentioned there your sister. I've read a couple of comments from her saying that you were born too soon. So I kind of wanted to get an idea of, as you became a Lioness, what kind of support did you receive, I suppose, from the camp? And how did you work that around, your time at Boots as well?
Well, like I say, I know a lot of girls weren't so lucky there to take their holiday time.
Mm-hmm.
So if they were playing for England, now my company, they did get quite a good plug because when I scored in the cup final, it was on BBC News and they weren't allowed to mention companies, obviously, in those days. But the newsreader said it was the ladies' cup final today and Pat Chapman scored whatever many goals
Six.
It was. Yes, thank you. And when she hasn't got her shooting boots on, she works at a very well-known high street chemist, you see. So that's when Boots really got on board with it. And when I played at the final at Kenilworth Road, they actually sent a photographer that followed me.
Mm-hmm.
So I've got some really lovely photos of the Kenilworth game. But my sister is my biggest fan. Obviously, my dad's not with us now. But obviously, my dad was my strongest critic as well. But my sister, all my sisters and brothers, because there's seven of us, were my biggest fans. But she always says, and this is what she said, Pat, she said, you were born 30 or 20 or 30 years too soon. Because I think she wanted for me what the girls have got now.
Mm-hmm.
But, I enjoyed my career. I loved every minute of it. And, as I say, I was one of the lucky ones. I had very supporting parents. When I think, I don't know how they afforded it when I think back. I'm not quite sure how they, but, they did everything for me, as did my company. So, I can't complain.
And I think, the game wouldn't be where it is now if it wasn't for people like you. So I know born too soon, but also a very important piece of this journey. Looking around the dressing room back in 1984, mm-hmm. what were some of the challenges you would maybe help other girls with that, say, current, Leah Williamson as a captain or whoever has the armband now maybe wouldn't have had to consider?
Well, we were never together for very long. If we were only together, say, for about 2 days. Carol Thomas was the captain then. It was all different. I mean, I can't, you know, we had to make our own way to wherever we were, you know, had to meet up. We had one set of training gear. We had to wear our own boots. We didn't have any boots given to us or kit given to us. And most of the kit that was given to us didn't fit. You know, I'm not very tall, so everything I had was too big. So, you know, Leah Williamson, I've got huge respect for. I think she is a fantastic role model. And having met her, she did not disappoint.
And how did your meeting go with Leah Williamson? Did you give her any advice or what did she say? Yeah.
We met at, we went to a training session up in London, and the England team were training. So we had the opportunity to watch them train, which I thoroughly enjoyed. Again, we had nothing like that. I mean, I think we had about half a dozen balls if we were lucky. We'd made our own way there. We'd met up and sort of had a good chat, and then we went straight out to the training ground. She was actually injured, and I'd met her in the corridor, and I said to her, you know, what have you done? And that's when she was first injured. And she asked me if I was a, you know, an older lioness, and I said I was. And she said, you know, we couldn't have done any of this without you, which I thought was just wonderful. Mm-hmm. And there's a young girl that plays football in Portsmouth, and Leah Williamson is her idol. And I asked her if she'd write something on a piece of paper for her. So she asked me her name. And I told her her name, and she put this lovely message on. And I have to tell you, this little kiddie was thrilled. Oh. So she did not disappoint, as did none of them disappointed, because when we met them and went on the pitch, they formed two sides and clapped us on, which I thought was wonderful.
Love that. Did you not have a kick about with them all? Like all five aside? The current and the formers.
you've got to remember, I'm nearly 68 years old, so the knees and the hips won't take it, unfortunately.
I love to hear that, though, because I think it is really important that current lionesses know what you went through and, you know, the sacrifices you made to play. Mm-hmm. You know, we've spoken to people who've been involved in the game for a long time, and I think they sometimes don't see themselves as trailblazers, which is a real shame, because, you know, without you pushing and playing these games and, you know, getting the Federation to support you, and, you know, we wouldn't be where we are now. And I think it's really important that we recognise that. So it's great to hear that you had that experience and rightly got clapped onto the pitch. I love that.
Yeah, wonderful, wonderful.
Talking about, so we've spoken a little bit about the support you had as lionesses. What were your impressions of other national teams, like in terms of how prepared they were or equipped they were? You say Sweden were obviously playing at their main stadium. Did you notice a big difference?
Yeah, there was a huge difference. The teams at the time were the Scandinavian teams. Sweden were way ahead of us with everything, the way they prepared, their kit, you know. Norway, Denmark were a very big team at that time. And the other big team at that time was Italy. Mm-hmm. So they were way ahead of us. I mean, we played at the Olympic Stadium in Rome, which was just wonderful. I mean, whereas we were playing in like non-league venues, but they were way ahead of us. And that's why it was so big that we got to the final, because we played Denmark in the final. And I think at that time they were maybe the number one or number two in the world. So that's why it was such a big thing for us to get to the final.
Well, it's weird because we were talking a little bit about the Copa 71 documentary not too long ago, and sort of some of those teams you mentioned there were sort of, you know, one of the ones to watch. There was a couple of like feisty encounters between the sides. Were there any players that you sort of came up against, I suppose, that sort of, you know, put the fear in you, that you sort of you feared, or ones that you particularly targeted, I suppose, in those games in the sort of lead up to the finals?
The Scandinavian teams were just very skillful. The country that I don't think has changed was Italy. So that, you know, if you got past them, you never went any further.
Mm-hmm.
So I went, I played Italy at Wimbledon. I was just past the halfway line, got past the defender, but then I didn't get any further because the shirt was nearly off my back and I was on the floor. So Italy was the team, very physical. And I remember that quite clearly. But yeah, at Wimbledon, Italy were the team that were, I never liked playing them, funnily enough. They were, you know, they would stand very close and hold and, you know, well, they do it now, don't they? So, you know, it's no different, is it?
Yeah, it's interesting how, like, national team styles kind of stick around over the years, isn't it?
Yes.
You would have come up against Pia Sundhage, right? She, you know, our listeners would know her as manager of Brazil and Sweden. Now I think the Swiss team. What was that like?
She's wonderful. We spoke after the game. She was just a wonderful player, lovely temperament, just a footballer. You know, no edge to her, nothing to her. She was just a wonderful player, an absolute wonderful player. You know, right up there with maybe the greats, I would say. Yeah.
Well, listen, you must have some wonderful memories. I know you've touched on some of the photographs you had, but some of those venues you played in, Rome and Sweden, you must have some incredible memories. It's been lovely to hear about them as well.
Yeah, we do have some. I mean, obviously, the cup final scoring 6 goals. I mean, that was, you know, an obvious highlight. The European final, you know, for all these years, we were the only English team to have got a silver medal. So, you know, that was great. I suppose the biggest disappointment for me was the fact that it took the FA so long to recognise us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe they could have done that a little bit sooner, but, you know, I have my cap here. So I am number 33.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, so, you know, we've got there eventually. I enjoyed every minute of it. I'm very proud to have played for England. So yeah, I mean, would I change it? Yeah, I think I'd be lying if I said no. I think I would love to have been. I would love to have been professional, but, you know, hey ho, that's the way it is, isn't it?
And what was that process like? How did it sort of come about that the FA then got in contact and said, actually, we sort of want to recognise your achievements and what you've done for the Lionesses? Did they ring you up or send you a sort of like some parchment? Was there anything that they could have done that was grand enough to sort of, you know, appreciate and acknowledge what you'd done for the game? How did that all work?
Well, there's a lady that, in my opinion, has done the most for women's football, and that lady is Pat Gregory. Now, Pat Gregory has done more for women's football than any other person I know. And she just never stopped. She never stopped hounding the FA for a cap, for recognition, for, you know, for everything the girls did from 1972 onwards. So I think she pushed and pushed and pushed until the FA thought, well, actually, we need to do something. And so they invited us to London, to Wembley. It took them a while to get the caps, because in actual fact, that is the only cap I have. And yet I played over 40 times for England. So, you know, it took them a while, but I think the person that really needs a lot of recognition is Pat Gregory, because she has done wonders for women's football.
Well, thank God she has.
Mm.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, it's been wonderful speaking to you. I feel like we could have talked longer. I'd love to dug into more of your story and your memories, but it's been lovely hearing from you. And thank you for what you've done for the women's game.
Thank you.
We hope you continue enjoying the matches and maybe watching the game as well on Friday. Thank you very much, Pat.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
A quick question, Pat. Now that you are officially hanging up your boots, pardon the pun, what will you be getting up to in your retirement?
Well, I do what most footballers do. I actually play a lot of golf.
Oh, okay. Wow.
Yeah. So, yeah, I play a lot of golf. So I'm off to a few places to play. And, you know, I follow all sports, but, I play a lot of golf and I enjoy it.
please enjoy all the time with your golf clubs and your amazing cap. Thank you so much for sharing that with us.
You're welcome.
Thank you for listening. Rach, where are you heading this week?
Well, we've obviously got England versus Sweden at Wembley, and then in Dublin next week for the Ireland-England game.
Well, I'm slightly annoyed. My friend, who's very much into football, decided to plan her wedding for Friday.
Rude.
So I'll be at the wedding, obviously looking at the score updates on my phone. But yeah, that's where I'll be as well. So
rude.
I know, very irritating. I'm glad that she got a mention on the pod. Make sure you join us for a bonus episode on Thursday where Rachel will be joined by Emma Coates, head coach of the England 23s. Under 23s, I'm assuming, not over 23s.
Singularly 23s, yes, actually under
just 23s. The 23s. It's been a very exciting time for the under 23s after training with the senior squad in the last international break in the sun. So we wanted to get the inside track on how things work in the under 23 setup. In the meantime, you can find us on Instagram and X. I am at Morgie_89. Rach is at Girls on the Ball, and we are at Upfront_pod. You can also find us on YouTube at Upfront Pod. See you next week.
Upfront is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.